Hey, everyone. I'm Amy Standen, Ear Hustle's editor.
And I'm Rahsaan New York Thomas, Ear Hustle producer. And do you believe, Amy, they left us alone to kick off the fundraiser?
We better not blow it, Rahsaan. The stakes are high.
We're going to blow it. We just have to find new jobs, I guess. This is the second Ear Hustle fundraiser I've been here for, and I never knew how much the show relies on listener support.
It really, really does. From now through the end of this season in June, our goal is to reach 1,000 donors.
So, Amy, for folks who donate, should we tell them where that money goes?
Sure. These donations help fund our ongoing work, but also things like getting us into prisons where we've never been before. Like if you enjoyed our episode about the hospice program at CMF, or the ones we've done with the women we've been meeting at the world's largest women's prison, CCWF. And there's also some really cool behind-the-scenes stuff, like developing an Ear Hustle curriculum for high school teachers.
Listener donations support all of that. Plus, this year, supporters will be invited to join us for a virtual party on June 13th, and they get a playlist of songs picked by the team.
And everyone who donates $10 a month or more will get access to Ear Hustle Plus, which is our new subscription service with ad-free episodes and bonus content.
Find out more and donate at earhustlesq.com.
Listener support means so much to us. Thank you. Should we give the mic back to Nigel Nerland now?
Not yet. We just got it.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare.
All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Why did you want to be a police officer?
I wanted to help people that they couldn't help themselves, and to actually like work in the community I grew up in was cool. I was attracted to just being a part of the community, being able to get involved in stuff and make a difference.
So before this happened, what's a day in the life of a police officer for you?
I don't think every day was the same. Mm-hmm. It was different. You pretty much get a whole gamut of calls. You could be answering a false alarm to a bank robbery to child abuse case to, I mean, it just all depends.
How did you feel about wearing the uniform?
Great.
Did you like take pride in it when you put it on?
Oh, absolutely. You have authority. Like you walk in a room, people know who you are, but they don't know why you're there, but they're looking at you for direction.
What did it feel like to have that kind of power?
I guess entitlement. Like I got to do whatever I wanted, pretty much. I had the car, I got a badge, I got a gun. Like I could basically coerce you with my words to have you do what I want you to do.
And what does that do to like someone's ego?
It could be a dangerous thing.
Erlon.
Hey.
This is a pretty tough episode.
That's right, Nige.
So please use discretion while listening.
And take care.
I'm Nigel Poor.
I'm Erlon Woods.
And this is Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Hey, New York.
What's up, E? What's up, Nige?
Hey, good to see you.
we brought producer Rahsaan New York Thomas into the studio because, New York, you're the one who first introduced us to Eduardo. Want to tell us how you met him?
When I was incarcerated at San Quentin, we both lived on the fifth tier, so I used to see him all the time. But I really noticed him when I saw a big crowd around him on the yard and he was preaching.
Yeah, I remember you told us, like, there's this, like, new preacher at San Quentin and you might want to talk to him.
Exactly.
All right, so one of the things that impressed me about you is that I would see you preaching on the yard and it'd be like this loud, large crowd around you. How did that get started?
So we gathered on the yard, we grabbed our Bibles, and we just started preaching to whoever showed up. And before you know it, it just started growing and growing each week. And we ended up implementing some worship in there. We do communion out there. We made a space for people to come and get prayer. And we functioned like that for a little bit.
You said you did communion on the yard?
Right.
How did you do that?
Well, we had someone bring crackers, and we had someone bring Kool-Aid, and we had communion.
And who administered it? Is that the sacrament, right?
Wait a minute, Notch. He just said they did communion with Ritz crackers and Kool-Aid.
Ritz crackers and Kool-Aid.
I got it.
Yeah. Well, it stands for the body and the blood of Christ, so. Yeah.
The wine and the wafers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you change when you were in front of the congregation? Like what would change in your body or your face or your voice or the feelings inside?
Certain times and certain messages, like I'd start to weep because of what the passage actually really meant to me. Especially when you start speaking about what Christ did for us, you know. And in your mind, you already know, like, the worst of the worst, who you are, what you've done. And then to think of a God who came down to die for all that sin, I mean, sometimes that gets really overwhelming. You're talking about it and you're recalling your life, and it puts you in such a humble and broken place.
How did you get started preaching? Like, when did you first become a Christian?
I knew church, I just didn't know Jesus. So it wasn't until I got to county jail and I didn't have anything. I mean, I lost everything, family, friends, possessions, everything was gone. And this deputy, he asked me if I had anything to read. I'm like, no. And so he slid a Bible on my door. And I was like, well, it's better than nothing. Being alone with your thoughts is torment. So I just started reading the Bible. And I just kept reading and reading. And I made a commitment to God. And I said, you know, Lord, if you could do something with this life, if you could take all this brokenness and do something with it, then it's yours.
Listeners should know that Eduardo is not his real name. State prison officials asked us to use an alias.
10 years ago, before Eduardo came to San Quentin State Prison and started preaching, he was a police officer working a night shift in Sacramento, California.
I was married, had children, nice house, car. I got really good at compartmentalizing. Like, once I got off of work and I shedded all my uniform, then it's like, okay, now I'm the family guy.
I'm wondering if there's, like, when you put on the uniform, if it somehow allows us to become a different personality. Because you just said, like, you'd go home, take off the uniform, and then you were the dad and the husband. Yeah. And all that stuff.
People I worked with, they had no idea what was going on either. Mm. So I was able to make it look like I was doing my job, but then when there was a lot of downtime, I'd go out and commit crime. Obviously, there's a progression to why you commit your crime. But there's just a one day, one opportunity, and I chose to say yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you see it coming, that change that was going to happen in your life? Was it something you've tried to push down, or did it take you by surprise?
I don't think it was a feeling of surprise. I think it was something that was always in front of me, and maybe I was tempted before, but I said no. And then one day I just gave myself permission to be like, no, okay.
I want to jump in here to warn people that this crime he's going to talk about is sexual assault, and there are graphic descriptions throughout this episode.
I guess I could take you back to the day that I crossed that line. I was on duty. It was at night. It was the middle of the night. And I seen a female walking down the street. She was covered in a blanket. And so I stopped, asked her what she was doing out there. Obviously around that time, they're only out there for a couple things. So while I was talking with her, I found some drug paraphernalia and stuff. I placed her in the back of the car, and she was arrestable. Usually at night, if you find someone, they have a minor crime, you might want to ask them for some information. You could let some things go with the warning. Things like, you have some discretion. She said that she didn't want to go to jail. She was on drugs. She didn't want to get sick. So I kept asking her about information. She said she wasn't a snitch. And I think she felt like that I wasn't going to let her go unless she gave me something. So she offered, hey, I'll have sex with you if you let me go. And I shut her door and I said, I'm going to get back to you. And I thought about it and ended up opening the door. And I said, all right, we can do this. And we drove to a secluded area and we engaged in sex, dropped her back off. And that was it. Being in law enforcement and having that authority, that power, that presence is too easy. Once you make that decision to cross that line, then that's it. Of course, they're going to give me what I want because they don't want to go to jail. You know, so I'm actually doing them a favor. Like, this is how I thought back then.
And did it escalate once you realized, okay, I can do this? Did it become really like obsessive behavior?
You could call it that, because I found myself at night when I was working, I would basically seek out women that were walking. I would stop them. I would try to find something criminal on them and basically lead them down the line of questions that would lead to them performing sex acts.
Yeah.
And I was doing that. I was a predator.
How long did this go on before you were arrested?
It went on for a year.
And do you think your colleagues suspected what was going on?
No.
No, really?
No, I got good at lying to them too. There were suspicions at one time, but obviously, I denied it, and they backed me up.
Did you live in fear of it coming out?
Pretty much after the first time I did it, I knew that I was done. It's just a matter of time. Because if they found out about one, then for some reason, I just didn't stop. So.
We knew going in that this was going to be a hard interview. I had read a little bit about his crime, which I actually never do before interviews, and it was rough. I remember coming to New York and being like, this is going to be tough. I mean, it's really hard to deal with sex crimes. It's hard to think about them. It's hard to talk to people about them. And you really have to check your emotions going into the conversation.
Yeah, there's this philosophy where they say hate the crime and not the person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot easier to do when you know the person and you don't know the crime.
Right.
When you know what the crime is, you kind of look at the person different. Like, are you fooling me, dude? Like, are you the crime? It's really hard to separate the two.
Yeah. So, I mean, would you rather just not know?
I don't ask, but I don't close my ears when the information comes my way. So part of me does want to know.
I mean, that's why in most cases, I don't want to know what guys have done. I just want to, you know, meet them where they are now. But in a story like this, you can't do that. What would happen when it was
just
over?
Drive him back to where I picked him up from.
And how
just drop him off.
And how would you feel at that point? Like, I don't know, like, was there ever any shame or anger? Or just like, oh, what the fuck, I don't, this is...
Probably the last one. Like, what am I doing, you know? tell myself, man, I got to stop. I'm not going to do this again. And, yeah, and I'm going to get caught, you know?
Yeah. Was there some point, like, during the looking for the person, the,
uh-huh.
yeah, the hunt, where was the thrill? Was it in trying to find the woman? Was it getting her clothes off? Was it having an orgasm? Like, what was the thrill for you, or the trigger, or the addiction part of it in the act?
I don't know. I think it's just having the power of over someone else and just having them do what I wanted.
Mm. Were they people to you?
No. No. I dehumanized them. I would seek them out. I know what they would be doing out there. I would find a reason for them to make a decision to either lose their freedom or do what I asked them to do.
Yeah.
They were nothing more but a means to an end for me. I didn't have to use, like, physical force. All I had to do was just pose them with the question, like, what do you got for me if you don't want to go to jail? Because I knew what they were involved in and what they did, I know they would lean towards that way. I let them ask the question, and I'd be like, okay.
Do you think they were afraid?
Yeah. I know that they didn't want to do it, but they did what they had to do to stay free, you know. I took something that didn't belong to me. I took their choice. And
I mean, what do you think it's done to their lives?
Man, I can't even imagine. I probably from that day forward, they probably had no trust in law enforcement. They probably didn't even feel safe in their own community. Probably every time they saw a police car, you know, I could only imagine, like, the fear that welled up inside of them. Like, is it going to happen again? Like, who do I trust? Who do I call for help?
Erlon said this one time about how when you commit a crime, you know, you steal money or whatever you do, but you're also taking something that's intangible, which is someone's sense of security and safety.
Yeah.
And it could be worse than the crime because it ripples out into the rest of their lives. So I wonder when something happens to you, like what you did, something is gone in them that I wonder if it can ever heal. How does someone come back from that experience?
It's like a scar, like the wound's gone, but the scar's still there, yeah. Reminding you of what happened. So, yeah, I did something that was going to affect them for the rest of their life.
So, Eduardo, I think you could tell from the way he talks, he's big into the group thing at San Quentin. And basically, that's guys who have committed crimes doing a lot of intensive group work to help them come to terms with what they did and the impact that it had.
Yeah, and in those groups, they talk a lot about trauma and personal growth. But I have to say, New York, sometimes I don't know when it's real or when it's a performance.
Yeah, I can see what you mean, Naj.
You seem so sincere, but you also seem sincere while you were a cop, too, right? Like, how do people know that this change is real? Like, because if you had this ability to be a father in the daytime and then this predator at night, like, how do people know if your change is real or not?
That's a good question. And I've asked myself that, too, because I got really good at compartmentalizing, right, who I was out there. And I asked myself that, and I'm like, man, could I be just deceiving myself? Am I putting myself through the same thing for self-preservation? But then the one thing that told me that I wasn't was I'm the same person that I am in my cell, that I am out on the tier, in the yard, in church, in the chow hall. I'm the same person. I couldn't say that for myself when I was out there because I was someone different. Behind my house, closed doors in my house, it was volatile. Out on the street, I performed, you know, with my friends, I partied, you know, I compartmentalized, but I was in secret. I was a horrible human being, but I'm not like that today.
Are you tormented by what you've done and the consequences of it?
Yeah, honestly, not as much as I was before. Not that I'm okay with it now. It's just that I could sit with it now. And I could ask myself questions about it and like look for answers. And if I start talking about it in a group, I mean, it's going to break me down because of the guilt I feel about what I did, you know. But I'm understanding that that's not who I am, that I'm different now. But I could talk about what I did, and hopefully I'm able to help someone else understand or heal or grow from what they did also by dealing with my stuff. So if I just lived in a place of shame and unforgiveness and guilt and bitterness and all that stuff, I'm no good to anybody.
I really hear what you're saying, and yeah. I agree with all of it. I don't want people to just live in pain, you know.
Yeah.
But I do think a lot about victims too, and I just wonder like who's holding those women.
Yeah.
What would happen if you had the opportunity to sit across from one of them?
Wow. Well,
would you take it?
I would. Because I want them to truly hear from me how sorry and how remorseful I was for what I did, because they didn't get that when I was out there. They seen a monster in front of them. I just took something from them without any care. I want them to sit in front of me, and I want to tell them that they're worthy and what I did to them was wrong. I just want to be there for them because I wasn't for them before. I was in a position to help them, but I hurt them instead.
Yeah. I remember leaving San Quentin that day, and I was really unsettled. I mean, I don't think it comes across on the tape at all, but Eduardo just wasn't what I expected him to be.
Yeah, to me, he seems very, very sincere.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I could not tell what crime he's in prison for. I had no clue. Based on his demeanor, his daily walk, his position in the church, you just can't see any signs of how he used to be.
Yeah, I know. Like, so when he was sitting in the chair, he had like really good eye contact. He wasn't shifty. Like he was really soft-spoken. I didn't get any weird vibe from him. And I expected to have this really visceral, negative reaction to him. And it just didn't happen. And I have to say, I found it really confusing because my assumptions and my experience just didn't go together at all.
But you got to remember, this is a guy that's drawn to a position of power. You know what I'm saying? First as a police officer and now as a preacher.
I know. So I keep coming back to, like, were we being manipulated? And it really nagged at me.
So a few months later, we asked Eduardo to come back down for another interview.
And we'll be back after the break with that conversation.
I'm Shankar Vedantam, here to tell you about a great mystery. That mystery is you. As the host of a podcast called Hidden Brain, I explore big questions about what it means to be human. Questions like, where do our emotions come from? Why do so many of us feel overwhelmed by modern life? How can we better understand the people around us? Discover your hidden brain. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for Ear Hustle comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/earhustle. That's odoo.com/earhustle. Odoo, modern management made simple.
I know last time we started by praying. I don't know if you want to do that again before we talk. It seemed like a nice way to get into the conversation. It's up to you.
Sure. Yeah, if you would like me to.
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, sure. So, Father God, Lord, I appreciate this responsibility of being here. I pray that you bless this time we have together. Lord, let everything that come out of my mouth, Lord God, let it be real, authentic, and let it glorify your name. I thank you for the people who do this, the lives that they touch, and I just pray that you bless them for the work that they do. In Jesus' name I pray, amen.
Do you remember how you felt after you spoke with us?
It felt like a blur. Like, I don't even remember nothing I said. It was just like firing off questions and answers, and I know it was intense, mm-hmm. and I was kind of like drained afterwards.
Did you leave with any regrets or things that you wish you said or didn't say?
No, the only thing that like really weighed on my mind was when I do something like this and something's going to be basically outside these walls, like my own concern is like who I don't want to injure who I injured. I don't want to cause more harm to like my family or the families of the victims. That was like where my concern was. And I just recently got in contact with my daughter again after 10 years. And it's like, these are things that are out there now. She was 12 when I left. So she's a 22-year-old woman now. And it's like, I don't know if she's ready to hear something like that, but she is, she's mature. I'll give her that.
Does she know why you're in prison?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's got to be a hard conversation.
Right.
Yeah. Were you prepared for prison?
Absolutely not. Well, considering what my occupation was and my crime, the prison system was not something that was very gentle to me. I was able to keep it quiet for a long time. I was scared for my life. People would ask me, how much time you got? You know, where you from? And all this stuff. And they could kind of put together, like, what you might be in here for. With my sentence, it was 205 years with 9 consecutive life sentences. People thought, well, you had to have killed somebody or multiple people. So they're like, oh, hey, what are you in for, hot one? I'm like, yeah, sure. You know, I'd admit to a murder, multiple murders, in order so they won't find this out. So I was in fear for a long time.
After the first interview, I had felt kind of unsettled because Eduardo just sounded so sincere when he was talking about what he had done and the impact of it.
But we couldn't tell if he was being honest about the extent of what he did. I mean, the way he described it in the first interview, he sort of implied that he felt the women had a choice.
Right. And obviously, Earlonne, they didn't have a choice. And the more we read about it and the people we talked to, it seemed to me that in the first interview, he kind of, what can I say, like diminished the violence of what he had done to those women.
Right.
And so in the second interview, we pressed him on that, and he told us this story.
So, a warning to listeners, this next part is graphic.
If you want, I could give you an example of one of my victims. So I seen her walking down the street. Is that the time of night when women would normally walk? Either they're looking for drugs or they're involved in prostitution. I pull over, and in my mind, I'm already thinking, like, what can I get on her so I could hold it over her to get her to do what I want to do? I already had in my mind that I was going to rape her. So I did everything I could to get information. I manipulated her. I said, I'll give you a ride somewhere so you could pick up an item that you wanted to buy. She got in my car. I drove halfway to the designation. I parked on the street. And I looked for information on my computer. I was looking for stuff to pin on her so I could coerce her to doing what I wanted her to do. At one point, she was just saying, just take me to jail. And she couldn't leave the car. The back doors were locked. And she was screaming. She said, just let me go. Let me go. And I said, not until you give me something. Not until you give me something. And I kind of posed it as, like, give me some information. Give me somebody. Give me something. I kept asking her, like, did you ever work in the street? Did you ever do this? I was kind of like pointing her to what I wanted without saying it. Finally, she just agreed to whatever I wanted. We drove to a secluded location, and where I forced her to have sex. When she was in the back of my car, she was scared. She didn't want to do what I wanted her to do. Even after hearing her cries and her screams, I didn't hear her. I said, you're just going to stay confined. I'm just going to keep you in this space until you agree what I want you to do. That one right there sticks with me a lot because I could still hear her.
Yeah. I mean, when someone's screaming like that and asking for mercy, How do you get to a point where you can just tune that out?
Because I didn't see her. I just see what I wanted. Mm-hmm. And for that, I'm truly sorry.
Yeah.
You know, Nige. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are going to be some that says, why are we giving Eduardo a platform?
Right. And, I mean, there's a lot of ways to respond to that. But, you know, I think the first is it's just important to try to understand how somebody does this. And the only way you're going to get there is by having a conversation with them.
Right. Nigel, can you... be a victim and ask him, why did he do that? What would your response be? Like, if she just say, why did you do me like that?
Why?
That's the question, too. And that's the thing I'm working on. But what I could tell you right now from what I know is that I was a poor manager of my emotions. I did everything I could not to address my problem, but find the easy way out. And instead of, like, truly meeting my needs, I created more chaos in my life. And it wasn't just my crime. I did it in my regular life, too. I was unfaithful, and I used sex as a way to manage my emotions. I needed to do this so I could feel better. And it got to the point where it was unmanageable. I started hurting so many people, and I wasn't stopping by myself. Someone had to stop me.
You know, if I were the victim and I heard that, I'd be so mad because... you're saying it like you're just reading a list. Like, I don't feel your pain. I don't feel your shame. I don't feel that you want to die, which I think you should. I'm not saying I want you to die, but as a bit, like, I would be so angry right now. I don't know if you're saying that way because you've thought about it a lot or because it's an interview and it's not real, but I don't feel anything from you right now. And maybe we're asking you to do something that you can't possibly do. But that's my immediate reaction right now is I would just want to scream. Be like, what the fuck? Do you know how much you tore me apart?
Right.
And I don't see any emotion.
That's fair. I don't know how I tore you apart. I don't think I'll be able to understand how much I tore you apart. What I'm speaking on right now is I'm speaking from a place where I'm at right now. I'm trying to figure out why I did what I did. And if I could learn how to articulate it the best I can so you could feel that you believe what I'm saying, then that's my goal. That's what I'm trying to do. I want you to know that what I did was wrong, and I know what I did was wrong, and I want you to heal from that. I'm sorry for what I did, and my life is committed to making amends and to making sure that I do not ever do that again.
I just don't think there's any way for you to make me believe that.
I understand.
Do you believe him?
I think that's what makes this story so difficult and so important, is that it forces us to ask questions and hear answers that we can never count on. I have no idea. He had so much integrity in front of us, and my heart was so open to believing him. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think that he and his victims are in an impossible situation to ever really know what's in somebody's heart. It's just not answerable. And I think we want things to be easier and that there can be a resolution. And I'm just worried that there never really can be. For anyone, or I think you have to be pretty extraordinary to really be able to forgive and move on, to really accept the most horrible thing that you've done and figure it out and move on. It's really hard for everybody.
It is. I mean, how do you find the words for to describe like how you feel how horrible something is? I can only tell you the words that I know. But like you said, it's almost something impossible to explain. Like, how do you articulate that?
I was thinking if I wanted to describe my pain to you, if I was one of the victims,
yeah.
I could scream, I could cry, I could pound my fists, I could lunge at you. There's all these physical cues that we understand, rage and deep sorrow. When you're trying to explain that I've changed or that I feel this deep shame, there aren't the same physical cues. Like I just said to you, like, I want to see you be emotional, but I realize that we don't have a physical language for showing remorse.
Right.
Showing rage and distress is so physical. But it occurs to me that it's very hard to physically show remorse and have someone understand it through their body, but it's easy to understand rage.
The woman that I victimized, express however you feel. If you need to lunge at me, punch me, scream, do whatever you can. I want to make myself able to actually like really hear you, because I didn't hear you before. I didn't see you before, but now I'm here in front of you and I will hear you. I will see you. And I want to understand. That's all I can do.
There was another thing we knew we had to ask him about Earlon, and that was about being a preacher.
Yeah, for a man whose crime was about an extreme abuse of power, you know, the preaching thing was like, whoa.
When you're preaching, do you feel like a power over people?
To be honest, I feel like a nervous wreck up there. I'm just like, I'm like shivering me timbers up there, man. I'm just because out of reverence of the word of God, I don't want to do nothing that's not going to honor God.
There is definitely a power in preaching. Does it ever trouble you? Because it seems to me your crime was also about power and powerlessness. Right. Do you ever worry that there's a crossover in that feeling of power being satisfied by preaching?
It hasn't yet. It's not like they said, okay, you're a preacher, just get up there and start speaking. And then all of a sudden I'm that, you know. It's like a calling that you know for sure that God put it on your heart first. It's like, man, I'm inadequate. There's no way I can do that, you know, but it doesn't even fall on you. The consequences don't fall on you. It falls on your obedience to God and do what he asks you to do.
Plenty of people hide behind religion as a shield or a veil or a protection. Have you seen that? Have you witnessed that?
People hide behind?
Yeah. Saying that they've been redeemed or that God has a plan or this or that, but they really haven't changed. It's just another con.
Right. I'm not God, so I can't tell you who's truly redeemed and who's not. All I know is that we're all broken, looking to be made whole, right? And it's like, well, welcome to church, you know? We're all here, you know? Right. It's a place of growth and healing. It's the same reason why you go to a hospital.
But there's also people who have become preachers or ministers who are predators.
Yeah.
There's no doubt.
Right.
What if someone accused you of that? How would that feel and how would you respond?
Well, if they accused me of that?
Someone could hear this story and think, oh, yeah, he's just...
Oh, he's still doing that?
He's the same dude, but he's got God now to put forward.
Well, I hope they wouldn't say that because it's not true. But people are going to say stuff like that, you know?
When we were working on this episode, I really spent a lot of time thinking about the ripple effect. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were his victims, there was his family, there were the family of his victims, the organization that he worked for. It just, like, it went so far out, right? All the people that were affected. And so I have to say, I can see why religion and Christianity would appeal to him, mm-hmm. because there's, you know, in Christianity, this idea of forgiveness is huge.
According to my faith, there's nothing that can't be forgiven. Everybody's redeemable. You know, God came to die for everybody. It's not just certain people.
But if we don't talk about God, right. If we talk about other people and we talk about ourselves, mm-hmm. do you think that there's some crimes that can't be forgiven from that perspective?
I think everybody's redeemable. The forgiveness is for everybody. Without forgiveness, it's eye for an eye, you know, the whole world will go blind.
Well, what does forgiveness actually mean? What does it look like? What happens when forgiveness is given?
Well, when forgiveness is given, you're basically like releasing a debt. You're not going to charge something against someone anymore. You're releasing that so you could be free of that debt as well.
But does that mean the person just lets that go, what they did, and it's just off in the wind?
No, but I think it helps them move forward.
Can you see why it's a struggle?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
How do you think about the victims of your crime?
I think about them all the time. I make sure I remember their names. I remember if I'm doing work, I make sure that I name them. And it is a hard place to go back to, because when I talk about it, I go back to that place when it happened. It's heavy. I guess it's something that just doesn't easily come out of me. But if you ask me, I'm able to talk about it. The shame that comes with something that you did, it's like it's heavy. Sometimes, I don't know if it sounds weird, but sometimes I get scared that I might forget their names. So I'll, like, repeat them to myself to make sure I know that they're always at the forefront of my head.
So if you were sitting in your cell and you heard something like this happen to your child, how would you feel?
I don't know if I'd want to feel something like that.
What would you want from that man?
The man who...
If someone hurt one of your children, what would you want from him?
To be honest, I wouldn't want anything. I would want him to go away and never be thought about again.
Ear Hustle is produced by me, Nigel Poor, Erlon Woods, Bruce Wallace, and Amy Standen.
With help from Rasan New York Thomas, Naroli Price, and Tony Tafoya and Sai San Quentin. This episode was sound designed and engineered by me, Erlon Woods, with help from Fernando Aruda.
It features music by David Jossi, Antoine Williams, Erlon Woods, and Darrell Sadiq Davis.
Amy Standen edits the show. Shubnan Sigmund is our managing producer, and Bruce Wallace is our executive producer.
Thanks to Acting Warden Oak Smith, and as you know, every episode of Ear Hustle has to be approved by this woman here.
I am Lieutenant Giamare Berry, the public information officer here at San Quentin State Prison, and I approve this episode.
This episode was made possible by the Jess Trust, working to amplify the voices, vision, and power of communities that are transforming the justice system.
And please don't forget to sign up for our newsletter, The Lowdown. For this next issue, a few of us who worked on this story wrote more about the challenges of putting this together and, you know, commented on some of the things that are still lingering with us.
Subscribe at earhustlesq.com/newsletter. You can also find out more about the show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at EarHustleSQ.
Ear Hustle is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, creator-owned, and listener-supported podcasts.
Discover audio with vision at radiotopia.fm. I'm Erlon Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor.
Thanks for listening.
It's Erlon.
And Nigel.
Here again, reminding you to donate to our spring fundraiser today so we can keep bringing you more Ear Hustle.
Everyone who donates will be invited to our virtual party on June 13th. If you've never been, it's a fun time where we talk about the season and answer some of your questions live. Uncensored, live.
And I will be on a hologram so y'all can see me.
3DE.
On Zoom. Every donation, any amount, will help us reach our goal. So please go to earhustlesq.com to learn more and please contribute.
Thank you.
If you can find it in your heart, in your pocket, in your wallet, in the couch.
Radiotopia.